France and Belgium released statements supporting the ICC and the request for arrest warrants for the leaders of both Israel and Hamas. However, British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak criticized the ICC's decision, calling it an unhelpful development and saying, quote, there's no moral equivalence between a democratic state exercising its lawful right to self-defense and the terrorist group Hamas. For more, we're joined by Reid Brody, war crimes prosecutor, author of To Catch a Dictator, The Pursuit and Trial of Hissein Habre. His recent piece for The Nation is headlined, Who's Afraid of the International Criminal Court? He's joining us here in New York. And joining us from Doha in Qatar is Ilan Pappe, professor of history at Exeter University and director of the European Center for Palestine Studies, author of 19 books, including The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine and Gaza in Crisis, which he co-wrote with Noam Chomsky. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Reid, we're going to start with you. If you can talk about the significance of Karim Khan pursuing these war crimes charges. Karim Khan really supported as the choice by Israel in 2021 as the ICC prosecutor, and also what President Biden had to say as he called this basically an atrocious decision.
Sure. I mean, this request for indictment is really a watershed event in the history of international justice. You know, in over 20 years, the International Criminal Court has never a prosecutor requested the indictment of any Western official. Pro-Western government. Indeed, since Nuremberg, the instruments of international justice to protect atrocity victims have only been used for opponents of the West, like Vladimir Putin and Slobodan Milosevic, for defeated adversaries, as in Nuremberg and in Tokyo, or for, you know, outcasts, say, you know, African warlords. And this is the first time that a Western leader or a pro-Western leader is subject of an indictment request. Even the Palestine dossier has been on the desk of the international prosecutor for the last 15 years, and we've seen this slow walk that three prosecutors have treated these complaints. Even after October 7th and the terrible attacks by Hamas and the disproportionate response by Israel, there was a feeling that this prosecutor, Karim Khan, a very savvy British prosecutor who came into office with the support of Britain and the United States, was never going to cross that red line, that we were never going to see an indictment of Israeli officials, no matter how bad the crimes became. And I think that we were wrong. I think the magnitude of the crimes that were committed, the growing international consensus around the criminality of Israeli behavior, and also the decision by the other court in The Hague, by the International Court of Justice, that Israel has a case to answer, all made it untenable for the prosecutor not to move forward. And I think the reaction from the United States is, you know, the United States has always had this very conflicted relationship with international justice. The United States supports, you know, the War Crimes Tribunal in Yugoslavia, the War Crimes Tribunal in Rwanda. I've worked hand in glove with American, you know, war crimes ambassadors on a number of cases in Africa, in Guatemala, and elsewhere. But the line stops when there's a possibility that an American or an Israeli could be be brought up on charges. And 25 years ago, when we were in Rome drafting the statutes of the International Criminal Court, the United States' position was that the International Criminal Court had no jurisdiction over the citizens of countries that had not ratified the ICC treaty. And that position was defeated. And the ICC has jurisdiction not only over citizens of countries that are states parties, but on the territory, when crimes are committed, if Americans commit crimes in Afghanistan, if Israelis commit crimes in Palestine, if Russians commit crimes in Ukraine, the ICC has jurisdiction. And the position of the United States was, because they lost that fight in Rome, because they lost the idea that a non-state party could be prosecuted. The United States voted against the International Criminal Court. It's one of seven countries that voted against the court. And under the Bush administration, they waged a war against the International Criminal Court. They got countries to sign agreements that they would never hand over an American to the International Criminal Court. They passed a law called colloquially known as the Hague Invasion Act that gave the President of the United States the power to actually invade the Netherlands protect Americans who would be brought up before the International Criminal Court. When the previous prosecutor sought to took up these complaints on Israel-Palestine and started to investigate crimes in Afghanistan potentially committed by Americans, the Trump administration sanctioned the International Criminal Court. So they sanctioned the prosecutor and her family personally. And even when the Biden administration lifted those sanctions, the Secretary Blinken repeated the American position that the International Criminal Court does not have jurisdiction over the nationals and non-state parties like the United States and like Israel. So this is an expected reaction by the United States. Secretary Blinken put forward the idea of complementarity, which is also an important principle. Because the International Criminal Court only kicks in when a country is unwilling or unable to carry out prosecutions. And Israelis are saying, we are a democracy. We have an and that's what Blinken is saying. We have a democracy. We have a functioning judiciary. We can investigate these kinds of crimes. But the prosecutor addressed that yesterday in his warrant request. He said, it's not a question of whether you have a functioning judiciary. It's a question of what are you investigating these very crimes? And they are not. And so I think we're seeing around the world, and you mentioned some of them, a vast majority of countries around the world have come to the defense of the International Criminal Court and to the defense of these requests for indictments.
And Reid, I wanted to ask you, in terms of the several Republican members of Congress have threatened the prosecutor, Khan, saying that the U.S. Would, quote, sanction your employees and associates and bar you and your families from the United States. Your response to this kind of overt threat from officials in the U.S. government toward the International Criminal Court.
Well, you have been warned. You come after us, we will come after you, like the mafia. And I have to say, Karim Khan said in his statement yesterday that this could potentially constitute obstruction of justice. Actually, half of the prosecutions, successful prosecutions by the ICC, half were against warlords, and the other half were for obstruction of justice charges. So I don't think that, you know, the ICC prosecutor is going to be impressed by this. But I do think it's really par for the course. The 2 years ago when the ICC prosecutor indicted Vladimir Putin, all of a sudden you saw this change in American position. You saw the United States getting behind the prosecution. You saw congressional delegations to the ICC. You actually passed a law for the first time in history that allows the United States to cooperate with the International Criminal Court, even to provide funding. It's all because the ICC was then going after an American adversary. And now that the ICC is taking up cases at Hamas, but also Israel, we see a reversion to the previous position. You can't touch us. You can't touch Israel.
On Monday, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu denounced the ICC chief prosecutor, Karim Khan.
He is callously pouring gasoline on the fires of anti-Semitism that are raging across the world. Through this incendiary decision, Mr. Khan takes his place among the great anti-Semites in modern times. He now stands alongside those infamous German judges who donned their robes and upheld laws that denied the Jewish people their most basic rights and enabled the Nazis to perpetrate the worst crime in history.
That's Netanyahu. I wanted to put this question to Ilan Pape, professor of history and director of the European Center for Palestine Studies at the University of Exeter. Professor Pape, your response to your prime minister. I know there's a long delay. He is in Doha, Qatar, Professor Pape.
Yes, thank you, Amy, for having me. I think that there's nothing new in Netanyahu's reaction in two aspects. One, his and his colleagues in the Israeli leadership attitude towards international law that equates international law with anti-Semitism. Israel always treated international law as a threat that can disrupt its criminal policies on the ground against the Palestinians. And secondly, weaponizing once more the Holocaust, the Nazis, and Hitler in order to evade the most important question that comes out of the ICC. Is Israel and the ICJ rulings, is Israel committing war crimes? Is Israel committing crimes against humanity? Is Israel committing genocide? And even this tame, by the way, approach by the ICC. If you compare the allegations against the Hamas, the allegations against Israel are much tamer, and genocide is not mentioned in the ICC steps. Even that kind of clear allegations are immediately rejected without any significant rebut in terms of facts, in terms of explanation of the Israeli policies. Immediately they go for the messengers because they don't like the message. So I think there's nothing surprising in this. What is really worrying is not Netanyahu's response, but the fact that every Israeli politician, from the left to the right, stand by the prime minister in this hysterical and immoral reaction to an international body and to a prosecutor that Israel itself wanted as the prosecutor of the ICC. It's part of the Israeli lack of any lack of any response to international law, to international public opinion. And this is the kind of Israel we have in 2024. It doesn't care about international law. It doesn't care about international opinion. And the reason is that they believes that the United States and Britain would unconditionally support Israel, whatever it does, even if here and there they would hear some rebuke for certain actions. The ideology of the state, its strategy towards the Palestinians, the very genocide of Gaza would continue to be immunized by the United States. And as far as Netanyahu and even his rivals in the Israeli political system, this is really what matters.
Yeah, I wanted to go back to Reed Brody for a minute because we're going to be leaving you and then staying with Professor Pape. Reed, your sense of the practically what this means for Netanyahu and Gallant from here on in the future if these warrants are issued.
Well, yeah. So first of all, these warrants have been placed before a three-judge panel. I believe the judges are from Romania, Cameroon, and Mexico. We've heard, incidentally, Le Monde has reported that there has been attempts to pressure the countries from which the judges come from. Normally, it will take maybe weeks, perhaps more. For those warrants to be reviewed by these three independent judges. Then, of course, if they're issued, Netanyahu and Yoav Gallant and the others, they become wanted men in the same way as Vladimir Putin and Omar al-Bashir of Sudan. Now, of course, the International Criminal Court does not have a police force. It is not going to go into Israel and capture these people. But 124 countries have ratified the ICC treaty, meaning that if one of the suspects were to go to those countries, the ICC, those countries would be required to arrest them and hand them over to The Hague. Now, we saw in the case of Vladimir Putin that, you know, he goes to friendly countries like China, but he didn't even go to South Africa last year for the BRICS summit. South Africa, which is not obviously an ally of Israel, which is a partner in BRICS with Russia, told Vladimir Putin very gently not to come to South Africa. Brazil, which is hosting the next BRICS summit, is telling gently Vladimir Putin not to come. So the world of Benjamin Netanyahu becomes very small. Also, these crimes have no statute of limitations. So essentially, Yoav Gallant and Benjamin Netanyahu, as well as the three Hamas leaders, for the rest of their lives, assuming that they're not previously arrested, would be unable to travel to these countries as long as the warrants are pending.
I just want to say it's very interesting speaking to the two of you, Dr. Ilan Pappe, renowned Israeli historian, and you, Reed Brody, whose father, Dr. Irvin Brody, was a Hungarian Jew who escaped from a German labor camp.
Yeah.
And you respond to Netanyahu saying these are simply anti-Semitic charges.
Well, you know, I mean, for me, I mean, we've talked about this. I mean, my father was in German labor camps. I had family who died in the Holocaust. My father used to tell me that he would have gone and fought for the state of Israel. I mean, I understand in my bones how important the safety of Jewish people are, and the safe. And but I think that, you know, these actions by Israel are making Jewish people less safe. I mean, I live in Europe. I see a rise in anti-Semitism. I see it here, frankly, as well. I don't see how these actions by Israel are protecting the Jewish people, are protecting Israel in the long run.
We're going to break and then come back to this discussion. Reed Brody, war crimes prosecutor, author of To Catch a Dictator, also wrote a piece in The Nation around the International Criminal Court. And we're going to ask Israeli professor Ilan Pappe about what happened when he flew into Detroit Airport for some meetings, why he was stopped and interrogated for hours. Stay with us. Klaus Weiss. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we continue our conversation with the renowned Israeli historian Ilan Pappe, professor of history and director of the European Center for Palestine Studies at the University of Exeter. He's joining us now from Doha, Qatar, and there's a long delay when he answers a question. I want to ask you, Professor Pappe, about this trip you took to the United States recently. When you arrived at the Detroit Airport, you were questioned for 2 hours by federal agents about Gaza, Hamas, and other issues, U.S. agents only allowing you to enter the country after they copied the contents of your phone. Can you take us through what happened?
Yes, I will do that, Amy. But if I may, and I think it connects to our previous conversation, I just want to say that there's something bigger here than just the question of the ICC and Israel abiding or not abiding by it. I think that's a moment of truth for the international tribunals such as the ICC and the ICJ, because they would face governments that would not probably implement the rulings because Israel still has very strong allies. And I think the rest of the world, especially the global south, would watch to see whether the terms universal and international really mean something. So I think Palestine is just one case of many in which we have now a real struggle to define again what is universal, what are universal values, and what is international justice. And I think that's why it's such an important historical moment. Now, to come back to my ordeal, which was not that big, but I think is part of a bigger picture. I arrived in Detroit after 8 hours flight from London and was taken immediately to a side room by two federal agents. And they had two sets of questions for me. One was about my views about the Hamas, my views about what's happening in Gaza. Do I frame what happened in Gaza as genocide? They wanted to know my reaction to the slogan, Palestine should be free from the river to the sea. They refused to tell me why they stopped me, why did I have to answer these questions. And then another set of questions had to do with whom do I know among the American Muslim community, the American Arab community, and the Palestinian community in the United States. And that was followed by taking my phone for a long period, copying everything in it, and making me wait another time for phone conversations before letting me in into the country.
Can I ask you exactly, Professor Pape, what you answered them when they said, what do you take to be Palestine will be free from the river to the sea, when they asked you about whether genocide is being committed in Gaza, etc.?
Yes. Well, to the questions of do I define the Hamas as a terrorist organization, to that I refuse to answer that question. And I suggested to them that they should go and listen to my talks in the Michigan area where I will discuss this issue. As for the question of genocide, I laconically said that yes, I do frame the Israeli actions in Gaza as genocide, but again, I suggested that if they want a more detailed analysis of why do I frame it like this, they are most welcome both to read my articles and to come to the lectures in the Michigan area. As for the question, how do I respond to the slogan, Palestine should be free from the river to the sea, I said that everywhere where there is a river and there is a sea and people living between them, they should be free, which was a moment a bit ironical or comical when one of them tried to show me his geographical knowledge. And he said, so what about Saudi Arabia? So I corrected my phrase and I said, well, anywhere where there are countries between two sources of water, people should be free, which seemed to satisfy them at that particular moment. I have to say they were polite. I don't want to describe it as an ordeal. They were polite. But what really bothers me is why at all do they have the right to ask me, and what was the real subtext for this whole affair? And I have my own understanding of that, although I don't have the whole facts before me.
And Professor, you've been speaking to huge crowds of young people all around the world, and many of the students protesting U.S. Support for the war in against Gaza. One of your books, the Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, has been much read in recent months. Could you talk about this, that the Nakba or the cleansing of Palestine didn't happen just in 1948, but there's been a process of the ethnic cleansing, even going back to the British Mandate period as the British repressed the 1936 Arab revolt against British rule?
Yes. Yes, indeed. The Nakba is a bit of a misleading term because it means in Arabic a catastrophe. But really what the Palestinians suffered was not a natural catastrophe, but rather ethnic cleansing, which is a clear policy motivated by clear ideology. And that policy was part, an integral part, of the Zionist program for Palestine from the very inception of the movement in the late 19th century. Of course, very early on, they didn't have the capacity to ethnically cleanse Palestinians from their homeland. But already in the mid-1920s, when the Zionist community in Palestine was still very small, it was able, through purchase of land, on which there were many Palestinian villages, to convince the British mandatory power to evict 13 Palestinian villages, and that was in between 1925 and 1926. And then slowly this process of buying land and evicting the people who lived on this for hundreds of years brought the Zionist movement into a moment where it purchased at least 6% of the land of Palestine, which was, of course, not enough. And then they went to the big ethnic cleansing of 1948. But as we know, it didn't stop in 1948. Israel continued to expel Palestinian villages between 48 and 67 from among the Palestinian minority in Israel, which allegedly were citizens of Israel. Israel expelled 300,000 Palestinians during the Six Days War in June 1967. And since June 1967 until today, about 600,000 Palestinians, in one way or another, were dislocated and uprooted by Israel. And of course, now we have a magnitude of ethnic, or a case of ethnic cleansing that even overtakes the magnitude of the ethnic cleansing during 1948. So there is not one moment in the history of the Palestinians in Palestine since the arrival of Zionism in Palestine in which Palestinians are potentially under danger of losing their home, their fields, their businesses, and their homeland.
Finally, Ilan Pappe, as you express, more Palestinians have been killed in the last months than at any point in the last 76 years. More Palestinians have been forced to move, have been displaced than what happened at the Nakba at the time of the founding of Israel. What gives you hope? You are an Israeli historian esteemed throughout the world. You have less than a minute.
Yes. I would say that what gives me hope is that I do think that the Zionist project in Israel and Palestine, as we see today, doesn't have long to live, to exist. I think we are seeing processes, important processes, that are leading to the collapse of the Zionist project. Hopefully, the Palestinian National Movement and anyone else involved in Israel and Palestine would be able to replace this apartheid state, this oppressive regime, with a democratic one for everyone who lives between the river and the sea, and for all the Palestinians who were expelled from there since 1948. Until today. I believe that this historical process has begun. Unfortunately, it will take time, and the next year or two are very precarious and are very dangerous. But in the long run, I'm really hopeful that there will be a different kind of life for both Jews and Arabs between the river and the sea under a democratic, free Palestine.
Ilan Pappe, professor of history and director of the European Center for Palestine Studies at the University of Exeter. Happy belated birthday to Samin Farkanday and today to Tay Marie Astudio. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Embark Sustainability Society is an independent, student-centered nonprofit working across SFU campuses. Embark focuses on climate and food justice in their programs and initiatives. Some of their ongoing work includes their food rescue program, learning gardens, and sustainability career nights. Discover your role in building a sustainable future based on your unique skills and interests. Learn more at embarksustainability.org and follow along on Instagram at embarksustain.